you want to continue along the lines you were.
I think maybe that. If one were to look at this June 72 talks as a milestone, not in the sense only of a culmination, but in the sense of new departures, I think it is fair to say that we probably stepped to a new plateau at that point, and the sense of closer strategic cooperation was deepened at that meeting. The Kurdish decision would have been one example of that. Probably not the only one, but the Kurdish decision needs to be seen in terms of Soviet closeness to Iraq, the need on the American side to build the Shah, build Iran as one of the twin pillars in providing stability in the Gulf, but in reality a single pillar, with the Saudi pillar being a nominal pillar there for obvious necessary regional political reasons, but with the Saudi security development not having yet reached the stage of parity with Iran. So in that context, we were looking at ways to keep Soviet influence limited, and one of the ways in which Nixon and Kissinger saw us doing that was to demonstrate to people in the area that they would pay a certain price for being an ally of the Soviet Union. It wouldn't be just a home free relationship. It was going to cost them something to have a relationship. And the decision on the Kurds, I think, was made in that context, that here was a group that for its own reasons was bent on giving the Iraqi government a hard time. It was a group that had certainly ties across the border in Iran, and it was in that context and for that purpose that it was decided to provide assistance to the Kurds through Iran.
Now the CIA played a role in this, apparently. They helped organize the campaign there.
It was essentially a CIA operation in the sense that it was they who would have marshaled the logistical apparatus necessary to do that.
And when the Shah made the request, he took the initiative in this matter to bring the U.S. in, or was it more of a joint discussion that led to a decision? Or
that I don't know. Not having been present, I don't want to mislead anybody by characterizing who took the initiative. I doubt that Nixon and Kissinger would have had it at the top of their personal agendas. It would seem to me that, and here I'm entirely speculating, but it would seem to me that it would have been the Shah who would have had some feel for the couple Kurdish rebellion. Kurds were tricky for him to deal with as well, because of the very substantial Kurdish element in Iran, not to mention Turkey. And of course Iran had had its own troubles with the Soviet Union after World War II, when the Soviets played up to the idea of an autonomous Kurdistan. So the Shah knew that he was playing with a difficult issue, but felt, I guess, by that time that Iranian Kurds were sufficiently under control of central authority in Iran that apparently he wouldn't have done this if he hadn't felt that supporting the Iraqi Kurds would not play back into Iranian Kurdish communities.
Apparently, I've read somewhere that Treasury Secretary Connolly played some sort of a role in organizing or orchestrating this this operation? He made a special visit to Iran or something like that. Is that something that you heard about at the time? Or?
I think it would be too strong to say that he played a special role in organizing this. He did go to Iran, but I think it was not so much in this context. He probably was briefed on it in order not to stick his foot in the program in some way that would send confusing signals to the Shah. But no, I think the Connolly trip was part of another outcome of the June 72 visit, and that was, if our cooperation is to become broader and deeper, we will cooperate in a number of additional fields. And with the impact of oil pricing and oil revenues on global economic stability as a factor in American mind, it was natural then, as it was later on, to send the Treasury Secretary to consult with the Shah and add that dimension to the political consultation. But I think I see that in that context and not in the Kurdish context at all. We just would not have been consistent with the way Kissinger did things to share that with anybody. Moreover, the Treasury Secretary wouldn't have had much to say about that issue.
A little bit with the Kurdish thing. Now, did you monitor this, play any role in monitoring this operation from afar, or supervising the cable traffic or whatever on the airport?
The way it was actually done was that another member of the NSC staff who was in the political military work of the staff actually was the conveyor of Kissinger's instructions to the CIA. I worked with him to the point of offering staff support and so on, but I was not in the line of communications to CIA.
And this is Richard Kennedy?
Yes.
Yeah. He worked with the political military?
Yes.
Bureau. Okay.
Yes.
You suggest it was mainly an effort on Kissinger's part to suggest to the Iraqis that they had to think twice about maintaining a close relationship with the Russians. That was the major rationale for it? Or?
That's the way I understand the rationale. Now, he would probably put it in more sophisticated terms, but the way I put it certainly is rooted in a variety of things that were said at the time.
Did you get a sense of how far they would pursue this support for this insurgency, to the extent that it could actually realize its objectives, or just be sort of a needling type of thing that would be an irritant, but no more than that?
I'm not sure that those two options really existed. I'm not sure that it was ever in the cards that the Kurds would in some way win on quote-unquote. A success for the Kurds would have been to force the negotiation with the Iraqi government that enhanced their degree of autonomy. So success was measured in those limited terms. And I guess the objective was to make it possible for the Kurds to achieve objectives of that kind. So yes, I guess in that limited sense, that was part of the objective, rather than, it was part of the objective because that was the way to be seen to create an entity that could constrain the Iraqi government, cause it to suffer some limitations on its exercise of sovereignty. So to that extent, yes, but I think that meant maybe needling was the way you got there, a rather extensive, systematic, consistent, pervasive needling that would cause the Iraqis to pay attention to the Kurdish leadership.
That's a will probably come up again, but the Iraqi thing, as we go, when we talk about the Algiers conference. But so in terms of another implication of the meeting was, of course, what it was called the blank check policy. Do you think it's accurate to call that a carte blanche or blank check in terms of the U.S.'s, in terms of the Shah's access to American weapons suppliers?
Well, as a shorthand kind of phrase, I think it says something. Obviously, there's no such thing as a blank check. I mean, there are things that he couldn't buy because the U.S. forces were only developing them or needed them first or whatever. So there were all kinds of constraints of that kind. Probably not an accurate phrase in that regard. But in terms of is not being subject to the normal kinds of bureaucratic review, and indeed in terms of instructions not to second-guess him, which was quite unusual. Even the Israelis had to come and argue their case for new aircraft in terms of the Arab-Israeli military balance, and every year they sent somebody at a very high level to make it. Extensive presentations to the intelligence community and sharing assessments of the Arab-Israeli military balance, and then the justification of various kinds of equipment were made. The Shah was not subjected to that, and in that sense was free of. And I think you'll find in the various accounts of this period that the Secretary of Defense felt that there was no point going back to the White House and saying this piece of equipment doesn't make any sense in the Iranian forces. It's not a piece of equipment designed for a military force of that kind, and that kind of argument was not welcome. So in that sense, the Shah made the choices without being challenged.
Was there much objection from at the Pentagon or other agencies to this more formal approach?
Yes, I think so. In the sense that, well, first of all, there were people there who were accustomed to trying to gear what the United States sold to a developing country to not only the needs but the capabilities of that country, and there were some kinds of American military equipment that was very attractive in the abstract, but outside of the maintenance infrastructure of the U.S. Air Force or the U.S. Armed Forces in general, it would have been a maintenance nightmare. Just all the training and equipment went into handling some of the sophisticated equipment. Just didn't make it in the view of American military experts, the best choice, most efficient choice, the most cost-effective choice, the most usable choice for the Iranian forces. You can have people trained in large numbers to do maintenance on this equipment, then you were imposing a burden on the Iranian infrastructure that would have distorted the Iranian effort in ways that didn't make overall sense. But I think there were a lot of people around who were military experts who had that point of view and who chafed under this notion that the Shah would get a piece of equipment because it looked attractive to him and he had decided he wanted it. And he wanted it because it was the latest thing the U.S. Air Force had. And there wasn't much opportunity for it. I like saying, here are the functions of this piece of equipment. And we understand what your needs are. You could really meet your needs better with this other piece of equipment. That dialogue was cool.
Did any people at the State Department object to this policy? Well, I was just looking at this document recently. There's an abstract of an intelligence report from 1970 that suggests, and this is like from the abstract, there is no immediate military threat to Iran that would justify new inputs in military equipment. So they suggested that there's no military power in the area that could really threaten the Shah's Iran's position, basically, and the Shah's military requests were really superfluous. Did people argue those things at length?
And precisely that point that was put down by the Kissinger press. But that, you know, that would have been embedded in the approach of the 70s. The whole effort of the early 70s, we talked about it before, was to slim down military forces so as to leave resources for economic development, and to slim down those forces so that they made military sense given the jobs that those military forces would need to do. So there was a whole decade of particularly the impetus of the Kennedy period that carried through the Johnson period, and the bureaucracy was full of people who thought that way. We're talking about a fairly early stage in this administration, and this has not been knocked out of them yet.
Now, I got somewhere the sense, I forget where I read it, that at some point, perhaps in the early 70s, the Shah might have suggested that he would turn to the Soviet Union for weapons supplies if he could not get some kind of unlimited access to the American weapons markets. Was there any, do you have any sense of that was the case, or that was suggested in some sort of subtle way to the White House? Or?
Oh, I think our friends the Shah included periodically raised that kind of thing. I think, as a matter of fact, he did buy some equipment from the Soviet Union at various
cheap
points along the way, yeah. But, so you had to cope with it, on the other hand, given his aspirations to build the kind of forces he was going to build, it would have been a logician's nightmare for him to go very far down the route of such substantial diversification of equipment, different supply systems, different warehouses full of stuff, people having to be trained in different ways, having two aircraft on the line or two sets of ordnance on the line at the same time. What do you do in the heat of some kind of military action to make sure you got the right stuff, the right place? I think the underlying point is that you could sort of count on common sense to prevail and for the Shah to make this demonstration to up the ante from the United States, but not to go that route any wholesale way.
Now, also at the time this decision was made, the oil prices were starting to go up a bit, not like in 73, but there was some upward push. Would balance of payments considerations have influenced this approach to some extent?
I think that plus Iran's general economic success in the years at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s would have caused the Shah to be in a better position by certainly than he was in 1965.
I mean, the U.S. in terms of U.S. recycling money spent on oil for Iranian arms purposes, would that have played a role in the decision? On Nixon's part, or Kissinger, maybe not Nixon, maybe Nixon more than Kissinger, but this is a way to...
That was a general part of the Nixon administration policy, not just geared to the oil-producing nations themselves, but more broadly to sell American and military equipment as a way of overcoming the trade deficit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you visit Iran at all during this period, the 70s or early 70s or mid-70s?
I was there in
early 60s for that.
Summer of 69, I guess, July of 69, and I was there in 72. From the visit that we've just been talking about.
The 69 visit, do you recall the circumstances? Or
Nixon made a round-the-world tour in July 1969. It started in the Pacific when he was on the carrier that picked up the astronauts when they returned from the first landing on the moon. Then he went on to Vietnam, India, Pakistan, and I was in South Asia for the visit to India, Pakistan. He did not go to Iran on that trip. He flew from Pakistan to Romania, as I recall. But I stayed behind and visited Pakistan, then I went to Iran and made my first visit there. Yeah. At that point, just to become acquainted with the country, that was my first direct exposure to Iran.
Did you go outside of Tehran, or was it mostly in Tehran?
I went down to Isfahan.
What kind of impression did you get of the conditions of the country around that time?
Well, the basis of that sort of visit,
trying
to be an expert, but I was by that time, I followed Iran fairly closely. I was interested in its development, and we went out to, we did see some projects. I also, my 72 visit, I went to Kuwait, went into Iran, through Abadan, visited some economic irrigation projects and so on in that area before I went up to Tehran. So I think the impression I had, because I was shown the projects that were progressing, that were kind of reflected Iran's economic development efforts. That's what I saw. Country where there were projects being built. But I certainly wasn't shown a country in deep trouble. The other impression I have from those visits is the exposure to the, what I would call the third and fourth echelon of Iranian society, this what we would call the sub-cabinet level, the people. I remember, admittedly in small numbers, but still highly talented people at that level. Some of them had been Western educated and returned to Iran in the later mid-60s to participate in designing the development effort, managing it, and a lot of those people were tremendously effective. Now, or at least they seem so. As I say, the number of people like that we met at a Tehran dinner party were small in number, and I don't think I ever had any illusion that there were vast hordes of these people, but you had a sense of a country getting it back together.
Do you recall anybody in particular that you met, the Iranian officials that might be striking or interesting from that
time? Nobody that I think. But I remember that during the 72 visit, when I was Kissinger, we saw all the appropriate ministers of those governments. So. Okay.
Again, that May 72 meeting, did you ever see a record of the discussions with the Shah? Was there a written record that was circulated at your level?
Oh, it wouldn't have been circulated. I may have seen something at the time. I can't really remember.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you have any account of the meetings from any witness or something, or did Kissinger talk to you about it? Or,
I think enough to go on and do the job again. I don't have any precise memory of how that came about, but I think I have a fair feel for the way the meeting went.
Gary Sixbook, he mentioned that somebody told him that at the meeting, the Shah was asked by Nixon to be my protector in the Persian Gulf. Did you hear anything to that effect?
I've heard that story before, but I can't remember where. It probably wasn't from Kissinger.
Now, during this period, the early 70s, the Shah was involved in a number of regional, local interventions in the Persian Gulf. There was also the Kurdish affair. There was also, he gave support to the Sultan of Oman, who was trying to suppress a guerrilla movement in the country. Did the U.S. give any assistance for that kind of activity, do you recall?
It would have been encouragement, and whether or not we provided certain bits of equipment through Iran and so on, or supplemented the Iranian capacity to do so, I'm not sure whether there was direct confrontation between the MAG and Tehran and the Iranian forces and how to do that, I don't know. But it was certainly regarded by Washington as a very important demonstration of how the Nixon doctrine could work. And Shah was encouraged to do that.
And it's also, I think of it in Sixbook, that at some point in the 70s, the U.S. requested the Shah to provide weapons to Somalia for use against Ethiopia. Now, was this something that occurred in the Nixon forward period or later? Or
I just can't remember the other major effort, of course, with the Shah was part of the effort in Vietnam to show a number of different flags. In other words, to make it clear that this just wasn't an American war. It was a war by members of the free world who were concerned about communist takeover. And I think that Iran committed itself to do that.
I thought they provided medical assistance. Was there anything beyond that? Or?
I can't remember exactly what they gave. There was the one point, though, I think, where they were, I was going to say provide a squadron of aircraft, but I'm not sure that that's the case. Probably wrong in my perspective. But this was really in the, may have been even in the late Johnson period where the idea was to. It was in the late Johnson period, before the period we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned last meeting that you thought that the policy, under Nixon, Kissinger, the late 60s, early 70s, there was declining interest in maintaining any kind of a contact with local political elements inside Iran that might be hostile or unfriendly to the Shah. That was a sense. Did you get that sense of it? Do you recall if you had that sense at the time that this was sort of the official,
very
official
much.
Approach?
Yeah. Very much.
Yeah. I read also the corollary of that was that the U.S. became more dependent upon the Sabak for local internal intelligence information about conditions inside Iran. Was that the case, or?
I suppose that's true. Although I think the main liaison is the box for purposes of keeping tabs on Soviet intelligence activities rather than internal. I doubt that we would have had any kind of formal exchange on internal Iranian affairs, so that the box we may have absorbed the knowledge simply by rubbing elbows and each other efforts. I think whatever we learned about internal Iranian affairs would have come from the embassy. And again, I'm not sure whether the extent to which CIA ran with other agents on its own closed down that operation. I think we saw Iran through the eyes of the Shah and his covering. With the exception of those people in consulates and so on, they cut their own independent feeling. That occasionally voiced views that were at obvious odds with the views of the government.
Do you recall that occurring early in, say, early 70s, or any striking incidences of that? Or
well, one of the people who was actually in the embassy in the 60s, and who had this view that saw named Bill Miller, I don't know if you have any questions.
I've heard of him, yeah.
But he'd be interesting on all this. He was out of government, or out of the executive branch, out of the Foreign Service by the period we're talking about. Probably preserved his contacts with the Citizen Development in Iran well into the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So well into the period of the revolution, as a matter of fact. He was the person who was selected when the hostages were taken. You remember the two people were picked by Carter to go to see if they could talk with Khomeini and fill it for him. The other was Randy Clark.
That's right. Now, how long were you with the NSC senior staff? You went to the State Department at some point.
July 1974.
Now, late 1973, there was oil price explosion. As you said earlier, the economics people in the White House generally handled those matters. But was there any discussion, though, were there any efforts to put pressure on the Shah, or other OPEC countries to restrain prices or find ways to...
Well, throughout the Kissinger period, as Secretary of State, who was the fundamental the problem of getting some kind of getting oil prices under control in some way, and there was just a fundamental difference of interest between the Shah, who wanted to maximize revenues for his own internal, his forced draft internal development, and the U.S. who wanted to see some lowering of prices. And, again, there was a feeling that that the blank check, in a way, applied to in this area as well, in the sense that, there was no information to take on the Shah head on that issue. Not sure anybody quite knew how to do that, if indeed there's been an inclination to do so.
I recall people like Secretary of Treasury Simon suggesting that the U.S. Use weapons sales as sort of a weapon, as sort of a club to get the Shah to restrict oil prices or to get him to take a more cooperative approach with an OPEC. We'd like the U.S. views on that matter. Do you know that that was discussed, using the weapons, access to weapons as a way to induce restraint?
I could see that issue being raised in that way, but I don't know. Can't put that chapter here.
Okay. Now, when you went to the State Department in 1974, what were your duties? You were the intelligence division, was it?
No, for about a year and a half, I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Near Eastern Bureau, who was responsible for the peace, the Arab-Israeli peace process, and our relations with the countries in the Arab-Israeli area. I wasn't doing Iran anymore during that period. Then in December 1st, 1975, I went to be Director of Intelligence and Research in the department, which again just gave me global responsibilities, so that put me back in touch with Iran. And I stayed there until April 1978.
So that's 75 to mid to early 78,
yeah,
basically. Was there much discussion, or was something that essentially came to your attention, say, in the mid-70s, the question of the impact of military sales on the Iranian economy? Apparently there are people in the Pentagon, like James Schlesinger, who are trying to find ways to rationalize the arms sales process to Iran. Was this something that people in your division worked on or wrote reports on, analyzing it or monitoring the impact of arms sales, and have you making recommendations?
Well, it was certainly within the purview of the Bureau. I don't remember this kind of particular study of that. I'm sure that there were ongoing looks at the Iranian economy and the role of military sales in that. Certainly in the bureaucracy, there's more inclination to raise the question of the impact of sales on economic development.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I guess in the mid 75 or 76, the Kurdish affair was sort of wrapped up at the Algiers conference.
Yeah.
Did the U.S. play any kind of role in that settlement?
No, that was very much done by the Shah, and left us vulnerable to fairly sharp criticism of leaving the Kurds on and then letting them down. In fact, a number of colonists from time to time, not in any very large way, but from time to time, were rather bitter about letting the Kurds down. Whether they supported the initial program or not, they felt that it was a rather cynical exercise.
Mm-hmm. But Kissinger was, this all came as a surprise to Kissinger and Nixon, and I guess Nixon or Ford, the settlement.
I think the idea of a settlement was seen as overriding advantages in quieting down that fairly important area of the world.
Now, late in the Ford administration, well, may I actually ask first, with the transition from power from Nixon to Ford, was there any shift in Iran policy? Was it pretty much on the same lines?
I think it was pretty much concurrent. I can't think of any reason for shift. Ford's period was relatively short for other preoccupations.
Now, late in his administration, there was increased congressional concern, public criticisms about human rights problems in Iran. Did your division review those kind of problems, or look at those problems in studies, or do you recall that coming up as something to look into? Maybe either late in Ford, or maybe early in Carter, under the Carter period.
It was more pronounced in the early Carter period, because there really was another look at Iran at the beginning of that period in a variety of different ways, some of them forced on the administration by the Congress, and others internally generated by the administration because of this human rights emphasis. So I tend to associate the next moment of internal adjustments as the early Carter rather than late Ford.
So before we get to that, there's one other thing about Ford I wanted to ask. Currently, maybe this will come to your attention or not, but I guess around mid-75, James Schlesinger was more and more concerned about the question of arms sales to Iran, and requested that the NSC do a new review of Persian Gulf policy, generally, and arms sales to Iran in particular. Do you recall working on that or playing some role?
Playing a role in that.
Let's move on to the Carter period. Well, I wanted the question that occurred to me when Marcos was opposed last year, it came to be known that he'd given some contributions to American political candidates, I guess in the 60s and 70s, congressional people, maybe presidential candidates. Do you know if that was Shaw ever raised about the Shaw and taking part in any kind of political activities here in terms of fundraising?
I don't ever remember any allegations of that.
Okay. We move on to the Carter years. Now, this might not have come to your attention directly since you were in the intelligence division through early 78, but did you get any kind of a sense of what the implications of the human rights emphasis of the Carter years were on practical policy towards Iran in 77, early 78? How that actually made, what kind of difference that made in terms of, specific diplomatic development.
Yes, the consequences of the statements that were made obviously were to create a real tension and uneasiness in the relationship between the new administration and the Shah's regime. This was obvious, and Carter had to spend a lot of time trying to put that relationship back intact. If I can say a word, it reflects my own viewpoint rather than an analysis of anything. It seems to me that the fundamental issue that pervades this entire period from the late 60s on was the question of how the Shah might broaden his political base and expanded decision-making institutions in Iran in the last time. And the issue of human rights seemed to me belonged in a discussion of that kind, not in a published identification of Iran as a place where there were political prisoners, and not in the pressure by the administration to let people out of jail. Might have been. The question that really was for discussion was the one the Shah himself was thinking about, and that was how to liberalize political life in Iran and change thing. So to broaden the participation, it seems to me that there were certainly good reasons for Carter to have come to office thinking about the importance of the human rights dimensions of our policy, that somehow the translation into the practical politics of a relationship such as that in Iran got somehow defined in such a narrow way as to create problems for the administration rather than to create relationships within which the human rights issues might have been pursued. The Shah obviously had on his mind at the time questions about liberalizing your government. Now, if we go in and have those discussions with the Shah privately, Carter might have established a very creative relationship early in the game. It would have had possibly more chances of accomplishing human rights objectives than the approach he was taking.
Which is mostly to sort of focus on repressive measures, yeah, as opposed to the political composition.
It's sort of the international approach to Iran rather than an approach that showed concern for the underlying political objectives of human rights, which were to broaden the participation in the system and ultimately to encompass opposition elements in the system, which would diminish the practice of putting political opponents in jail.
Did you get a sense that Secretary Vance or Carter directly raised these issues in private with the Shah and tried to suggest that he relax repression or use the torture and so forth? Or was it much more subtle than that somehow? Or was it not even raised at all in private? I think Carter has done more to suggest that he did raise it at one meeting. But I'm not sure how common that was, or routine. It was
certainly the subject of dialogue, how that took place, that's sort of forgotten. But I think that also it would have had to be, it was an effort to reassure the Shah that we weren't going to be bold in a China shop siding with a political opposition at the expense of the Shah's government. Ultimately, we have to convey that assurance, of course, by the famous Carter visit to Tehran. I suppose the administration was well on its way to doing that. Of course, that by that time was on the eve of the year in which it all happened.
How much continuity would you say there was between the approach that Carter and Vance, you took in practice, and the approach that Kissinger had developed? Was there a fair amount of continuity, you would say, in basic thrust, or was there more discontinuity?
I think there's always more continuity than discontinuity in a major relationship like this, but the discontinuities were introduced came from a number of different arenas. We've been talking about the human rights aspect, which were problems were generated by administration statements. But at the same time, sometime in that first year, there was the whole episode of the sale of intelligence aircraft to Iran, a deep congressional reservation, which about the everything from the amount of money being spent on military equipment by the Shah to the question of whether or not Iran really needed this sophisticated kind of equipment and whether or not we were justified in providing advanced and fairly sensitive equipment that could have been compromised had the planes fallen in the wrong hands. Of course they did in the end, and so on. But there was a real congressional opposition to sales. I think this has been building up ahead of steam for a while in opposition to reaction to the so-called blank check approach. So you had the Shah observing that part of Washington reacting to Iran. Then he observed the administration's comments about human rights. So if you're looking for elements of discontinuity, if we put ourselves in the Shah's shoes for a moment, he would have observed some rather significant elements of discontinuity, even though the basic infrastructure of the military assistance program was very much ongoing.
Interesting, you mentioned a question on the AWACS sale a minute or two ago. I've read that a number of people in the State Department were in fact opposed.